Betsy DeVos was one of the most controversial cabinet appointments of the last administration, but her replacement has, so far, avoided causing waves.
I think it's really important that this agency leads with service as our core mission to help lift those communities that need it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll spend some time with new Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona. We'll also spend an academic minute giving public health its due. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When Joe Biden selected Connecticut Education Commissioner Dr. Miguel Cardona to be his education secretary, he fulfilled a campaign promise to name an educator with public school experience as his nominee for the post. Secretary Cardona took office on March 2nd and has been busy trying to fulfill another promise made by the president, getting students back to in-person learning. Secretary Cardona has 2 decades of experience as a public school educator from the city of Meridian, Connecticut. He began his career as an elementary teacher. He then served as a school principal in Meridian in 2003, where he led a school with outstanding programming for 3 to 5-year-olds, students that were bilingual, and students with sensory exceptionalities. The secretary recently sat for a long session at the Education Writers Association's annual national seminar. This year's seminar was a virtual event, and Dr. Cardona spoke on a Zoom session with Sarah Carr, a member of the EWA board. The secretary started with some opening remarks.
As was mentioned, I started as a 4th grade teacher. I loved the classroom. I still feel, you know, when I walk into a classroom, I still want to enjoy my time with the students. That's always the best part of my day. I served as a principal, as was mentioned earlier, great 10 years of my life as a principal. I had children as young as 3 in that building up to age 11, a variety of needs, different needs, whether they're learning English as a second language or children with autism, children with developmental delays, you know, so I learned a lot. I grew a lot there, but always a teacher at heart. There's a level of urgency that I want to keep as long as I'm Secretary of Education, because we have a lot of work to do. The first 100 days, there was a really bold effort by our president to, you know, prioritize education and really bring importance to what educators do and the role of education in our country. So I'm pleased to be a part of that. As far as reopening, data from February show pre-K through 8 schools, 80% are offering in-person learning options. That's 2 months ago, before vaccinations were prioritized, before the money was given for surveillance testing. So yes, we hit that goal that we set out to hit, but until we're at 100%, there's a lot of work to be done. And through the Help Is Here tour, I was able to visit, I think it was like 9 states or 8 states, 10-11 different facilities, just to kind of hear from folks, from students to educators to district leaders to parents, about what they're experiencing and what's working and what's not working. So that's going to help shape the work that we do at the agency. I'm excited about the potential for our country. I know the president understands the role of education, and I'm fortunate and blessed to be in a position where I can help move this along for our country. This is a once in a generation opportunity that we have here. Yes, the pandemic really, it was challenging. I mean, we're still in it, but we have a tremendous opportunity to hit the reset button on things that we know need fixing way before the pandemic. So I'm eager to do that. I look forward to a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll dive right in with questions. The pandemic has really underscored the fact that many districts need to rethink how they serve kids in fundamental ways and for the long term, and particularly when it comes to low-income children and students of color. Since we're challenging school districts to do things differently, what does the education department need to change about its policies and practices to ensure greater equity? And America is known for its local control of schools. And I wonder, has the pandemic in any way suggested a need to shift toward greater federal control?
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. You know, you're absolutely right. I think my passion in education is really allowing it to be that great equalizer. You know, it was for me. I was a first gen. I always say I was born rich. You know, I had a loving family. I didn't have a lot of material possessions, but I had a warm community, a great family. But I know that if it weren't for the public schools that I attended and the state universities, I wouldn't be Secretary of Education. If it weren't for the teachers in those buildings that really saw something in me, I wouldn't be Secretary of Education. So I recognize the importance of a good education. Yet, if you look across the country, since they've been collecting data, people that that have my demographics don't typically end up through that path, right? So if you look at the data, the achievement gaps and the opportunity gaps in our country have been exacerbated this past year have not fared well for many students of color, for students that are in rural communities or, students who don't have means at home. So we need to make sure that as we rebuild, that we're looking at that and not going back to old practices. At the agency, which is what your question was about, we really have to look at higher ed space, for example, public service loan forgiveness better, borrower defense. At the pre-K-12 level, we have to make sure that we're lifting and being very transparent about successes and needs across our country and providing support in those areas. I think it's really important that this agency leads with service as our core mission to help lift those communities that need it. So I really want to make sure we're hands-on, we're rolling up our sleeves, we're with them, problem solving with them. I think that's our role as an agency. And I look forward to doing that with a great sense of urgency, knowing that children and students are waiting in the balance there for us to be, direct and forceful in our efforts to make sure we're supporting so that everybody has an opportunity and success.
So you talked about problem solving with them. And you've also spoken extensively about the need to earn the trust of families of color across the country, who we know on the one hand have been less likely to have access to in-person instruction during the pandemic, and on the other are less likely to choose it when they do have access.
Mm-hmm.
What are three things that most school districts are not doing currently that you wish they would do to better serve and gain the trust of families of color?
I'll tell you three things that I know will work. So without doing a landscape analysis and looking at those strategies and whether or not they're doing them, I'll tell you three things that I know we need to do more of. We need to make sure that our schoolhouses are prepared to meet the social emotional needs of our learners. We need to make sure that that students are seeing themselves in the curriculum. You know, the work of Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop, Windows, Mirrors, and Sliding Glass Doors comes to mind, where we need to make sure that what we're presenting to students is sensitive to what their background is and what their needs are. So the social emotional piece, and students need to see themselves in their schoolwork so that we can engage them. That's number one. Number two, we have to make sure we're connecting families to the learning process. You know, my parents will always be my best teachers. I always used to tell families when I was serving as principal, you know, the parents are the best teachers and we play a supporting role. So what I want to see more of is a natural, authentic engagement of families. And I'm not just talking about PTO, although PTOs and PTAs are awesome. We need them. I'm talking about engaging with all families and making sure that, we're bringing them into the mix, because parents want the best for their children, and our success with the students is going to be based on how well we engage the family. So the social emotional piece, making sure students see themselves in the curriculum and see themselves in their learning and connecting with families. And then another thing that we're really going to focus on, it's one of my priorities coming into the agency, is making sure that our pre-K-12 education system is connected not only to higher education, but to the workforce needs. We need to make sure that we're providing better pathways for our learners. I'm at a community college today and I got to talk to some students who are having great opportunities here because they're thinking about different pathways. So we need to make sure that as we evolve to provide students opportunities to better pathways.
I know a big coverage topic and priority right now is the $130 billion in federal stimulus funding for public schools. And I wonder, as districts begin to spend this money, what most encourages you and what most concerns you? And I mean, you mentioned the need for authentic family engagement. And I know that states and districts are supposed to provide evidence of that. And I just wonder what accountability will there be to make sure that there's true family and community input about how this money is spent?
You know, it really is about the design. You know, you can't just have random acts of family engagement, right? It has to be intentional. It has to be designed. So I feel confident that states are looking at revisiting what it means to have families engaged. You know, this pandemic taught us that we have to be nimble, we have to be flexible, and we have to meet families where they are. So I'm feeling optimistic that it's not going to be some of the same strategies that for many families was ineffective. And it really is planning for a reimagined learning with families at the table, not saying, here's our plan, we want you to embrace it. It's, what are your thoughts on what it should look like? How should we engage families? So I'm seeing that, I'm excited about that. And, you know, one of the concerns is obviously that as we turn on the lights and, you know, the spring flowers come up and things start to look a little bit more like they did prior to the pandemic, my biggest fear is that we go back to practices that were comfortable before the pandemic, but led to the disparities in outcomes that we are experiencing as a country. So I don't want us to go back into that comfort zone. We grow when we're uncomfortable. So we're going to have to rethink education and ensure that the funds are going to those students that were impacted the most. So that's tough leadership, right? You're going to have to change what people are used to with schools. I always say the pandemic, when it ends, it's not going to mean it's easier work. It's going to be different work, but it's going to be equally as challenging to lead through the next chapter of education in our country, where difficult decisions have to be made because we have to address the disparities that existed before the pandemic.
So, I mean, do you envision rejecting or really strongly nudging state plans that you think are at risk of bringing us back to some of those practices?
You know, I'm a big believer in equal parts support and accountability, right? You lead with support, but it's critically important for the students that we make sure that we're supporting our states and helping in every way possible to help them in their efforts to address disparities. And that could mean that we're having conversations with states that maybe we look at plans and we see that it's not as clear as it needs to be based on some of the data that we see from those states. So, but at the end of the day, we want to partner with states. My experience as a commissioner of education in Connecticut, it's hard work and it's not always pretty, but it's the right way to do it. It's the right way to roll up your sleeves with folks that are educational stakeholders and say, this is the issue that we have. How can we solve it together? And listen to diverse perspectives so that whatever plan you have, it's the one that has the fingerprints of all those stakeholders on it. And we recognize why we're going in that direction. And there's generally better buy-in in it, and it's more sustainable than something where you have one person doing it and everyone expected to follow. I do plan on working closely with states. I do plan on ensuring that our agency is a service agency. At the end of the day, they need to feel supported, not only by the resources, but by the best practices that are around the country that we're going to share with them, but also our agency members being partners with them in the thought process.
Still to come, we'll hear more from Education Secretary Cardona on reopening schools and other topics. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Secretary of Education Dr. Miguel Cardona. He spoke earlier this month at the Education Writers Association's 74th Annual National Seminar. It was a virtual event. The moderator for the session is Sarah Carr, a member of the EWA board.
I want to go back to the issue of reopening schools in person, which you touched on in your introduction.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a clearly stated priority for you and for the president. And can you give us somewhat of a kind of your personal scorecard of where we are with that, you know, specifically with an eye towards what you think has gone particularly well and what hasn't?
Right.
And in hindsight, that target of a majority of elementary schools open by the first 100 days, was that the right goal to set? Should it have been more ambitious?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very complex issue to reopen schools in the middle of a pandemic. Having experienced that, again, you know, as a commissioner of education in Connecticut, I'll give you a quick vignette of kind of what I experienced some mid-March last year. I called the superintendent of a very well-resourced district and I said, you know, how's it going over there? You go, Miguel, you know what? We just turned on a switch. Every kid has a laptop. They all have good internet service. And we have all of our curriculum materials online where all you have to do is visit our website. And then I called another superintendent of a not so well-resourced district, a lot of needs in that district. And 4 weeks later, they still haven't communicated with students at all. Nothing. Not, hey, we're going to come back or, you know, go onto our website. So the disparities there prove a couple things. Number one, that we have to reopen with urgency. But number two, they're in totally different places. And Connecticut is small. In different parts of Connecticut, they were in different places. Another one, I had a principal, we were talking about graduation, in-person graduation last year. And I had one superintendent telling me, Miguel, I only have about 100 kids in my graduating class. I could pull it off at the, you know, local soccer field. And then I had another superintendent telling me, Miguel, I have 3,000 students in my school. There's no way you can do a one-size-fits-all. So those are some of the challenges that leaders across the country are facing. I am pleased with 80% of the schools providing, this is in February, providing in-person learning. I know it's going to be a higher number next week. But I still feel that same sense of urgency until all schools are open. There is no substitute for in-person learning. Every day that the students are not in school is a lost opportunity for emotional connections, for relationship building, for academic support, and for the school community to really wrap their arms around these children who for the past year are wondering what's going on. I do believe it was the right goal. I think early childhood, you know, pre-K through eight, it's much more difficult to teach a first grader, a six-year-old from home than it is a high schooler. But I still want to double down and I still want to make sure that the conversation is about reopening schools in the spring. Yes, we need to be thinking about the fall, but we also need to be thinking about what we can do to bring students back in now. That's why the Help Is Here tour, my message is clear. Do everything you can to get the students in now. Some places the ventilation, some places the trust, some places the fear of the pandemic are still preventing students from coming in. But in some cases, it's also the fact that some students didn't feel comfortable in school before the pandemic. So it really speaks to the issues that we have and the challenge that we have moving forward. But I'm really optimistic that we're going to get through those because we're going to be bold in our leadership and we're going to keep that sense of urgency.
Yeah, and it sort of connects back to that first question is just, do you think there's a need for greater federal and state oversight with some of the districts that are not communicating with families and not developing plans?
There will be ongoing relationships with districts, with states that will, not only with reopening, but right now we're assembling, you know, a group of folks whose focus is going to be on getting better data points, regular communication with states and districts, problem solving together. We lifted up the best practices clearinghouse Friday. We made it public. We had over 1,100 submissions of what's working in different places. And we went through those meticulously. We posted 200 right now. We're going to keep going. We're going to keep adding to that, but there are best practices. We're going to be providing support. But yes, to answer your question, while it's not the federal government's role to micromanage education, it is our goal to make sure that all children across the country are getting a free, appropriate public education, one where they have the opportunity to succeed in life. And I take that very seriously. And I know that it's going to be my role, it's going to be my agency's role to support states on that, but also call out where issues are happening so that we could work with them and make sure that we're doing what's right for students.
Thank you. Student loans were a big campaign topic, and candidate Biden promised 10,000 in debt forgiveness. You've already taken several actions to reduce the student debt burden, including extending the payment pause and forgiving debts of disabled borrowers. What's next? And can you be specific about a timeline for action and whether this can be done administratively or needs congressional approval?
Yeah. As you mentioned, loan debt has really impacted many families, many students, and getting out of it and seeing a pathway out of it is critically important. And I know that's a priority for the president, as it is for me. We're still working with the White House on the best path forward and negotiating what rights, responsibilities and rights we have as an agency and what isn't. So as soon as we're able to communicate on that, or as soon as we get to a point where we can communicate information, we will. But I think, Sarah, it's really important to recognize, too, that we have to kind of go down the river, right, to see where this is coming from and really stop the bleeding to make sure that our public service loan forgiveness is working. I know 98% of the claims were rejected in the past. I know that borrower defense is something that we also have to take seriously. I really am passionate about making sure that higher education, that we can quantify a return on investment. I want to make sure that our graduates are graduating with greater earning potential and going out there and buying homes and contributing and not being held down by debt. Unfortunately, that's the narrative for so many families. So while I don't have a specific timetable of when we're going to be announcing things, I can tell you that there's a great sense of urgency. This is going to be as much a priority for me as Secretary of Education as the pre-K-12 shifts that we have to make across the country, because I see the connections. And I know that a good education system is the best economic driver in our country. So we have to get it right on both ends, the early childhood end, but also the higher education. And the loan forgiveness and not getting into that position where 5 years from now, we shouldn't be talking about loan forgiveness because college should be more affordable. The opportunities for students to get grants, and they shouldn't be paying for the rest of their lives for an education that they're going to be receiving in the next 3 to 4 years. So I'm critically focused on that, while also knowing that loan forgiveness is something that is a priority for the president, for myself. And we look forward to communicating when we're ready.
Great. And related to college affordability, I mean, President Biden last week proposed the landmark move to make community colleges free and expand support for Pell Grants and HBCUs. Do you think that we should go further, and should all colleges be free?
I'm pleased that the focus is really on those that work to address some of the inequities that we see in higher education. We know how important HBCUs, MSIs, tribal colleges are, Hispanic serving institutions, to giving those students an opportunity to have a crack at college and be successful. And, I recently read that half the dentists across the country, Black dentists, are from HBCUs. That stuck with me. It's critically important that we make sure we're focusing on those institutions that are really serving students that have been underserved for a long time. And I think that's a great place to start and make sure that we're providing the support where it's needed most.
So that's sort of a no for now on expanding it past those institutions.
And not to say that that's not something that we won't be considering. I just think right now it's really important that, kind of like with the funds with the American Rescue Plan, there are some folks that were hit much harder than others, frontline workers, people who live in multi-generational homes. So we have to make sure that we're addressing those needs. Similarly with colleges, there are some institutions that really are providing support for those students that are underserved. And we have to make sure that we're taking care of those that need it the most, as well as looking at options for providing free post-secondary education. That's why the American Family Plan is focused on community college for everyone for 2 years. The students that I talked to a little while ago, one going into occupational therapy, a few that were going into the automotive technology field. There was one going into the sciences. Their message is, this is great for everyone. I hope everyone takes advantage of it. So there are efforts from the president to provide post-secondary education opportunities. I just hope it moves forward, because it's going to be a no pun intended, a shot in the arm for our country.
That was Secretary of Education Dr. Miguel Cardona speaking at the Education Writers Association's 74th Annual National Seminar. He spoke with Sarah Carr, a longtime education reporter and a member of the EWA board. Thanks to the Education Writers Association for giving us access to this year's event. We hope to see you all in person next year. The biggest lesson of the past 15 months could be learning the importance of public health in our day-to-day lives. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
COVID-19 has brought many unseen social impacts to the fore. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Isabel Custers, assistant professor of exercise and health science, examines one of these.
Amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, we have realized how much public health impacts every aspect of our lives. Think back, if you can, to pre-pandemic times. Did the general public know about the reach of public health? Were we equipped with the tools to evaluate public health information and to understand how every policy decision or neighbor's choice might impact our health? Probably not. In 2003, the National Academy of Science concluded that, in order to keep the public healthy, we not only need a trained public health workforce, but also an educated citizenry, suggesting that, quote, all undergraduates should have access to education in public health. This makes sense. Public health is, at its core, an interdisciplinary field. From the social and biological sciences to engineering, from financial and business management to communication and the humanities, public health combines all of these diverse fields to ensure innovative and robust solutions to our most pressing issues. Through widespread undergraduate public health education, we can coach students in critical thinking skills to learn the application of the scientific method to large-scale problems and solutions, to communicate clearly to diverse audiences, and to work effectively in an interdisciplinary team. Higher education has the power to draw people out of their comfort zone and to combine students with different interests, strengths, and life experiences. By creating a safe environment in the classroom where students come together to discuss important and difficult concepts, racism and sexism, climate change, inequity, and others, we can put the wheels in motion for a generation focused on change. Not only should we focus on the problems prevalent in our society, but solutions that can move us toward a healthier, equitable, and inclusive future. There is hope in the next generation. We just need to equip them with the tools to make change happen for our health. For the public's health.
That was Isabel Custers of University of Houston Clear Lake. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.